Looking down upon the people, he could see the fear and uncertainty. He could see the fatigue. Their shoulders dropped from the weight of their worries. From face to face, he could see that the fear was not so much revealing or enlightening as some good fear can be. It was deflating and debilitating and contagious. At this point, he knew that a fortress of doubt was emerging in his community, a fortress that threatened to cut them off from their destiny. Moses looked to one side and saw the children of Israel, his people, those deemed special, those special enough to have been entrusted with a dream. He looked at the other side and gazed in the direction of the promised land and the place where the dream was meant to be sowed and tilled and brought to harvest. And in the place between these two, Moses looked hard at what was caught in the crossfire, which was in part his own soul. Anguish emerged for Moses. He could see both that the promised land was at hand, but he could also see that the doubts of the congregation would not let them get there. "Yes, the land runs with milk and honey," they cried, "but it is filled with giants, the long-necked ones. We had better stay here where we know our place, where we are safe." But you know that was not what they were meant for, nor is it why they were given such a dream. Bible stories are great, but some argue that they cannot be believed, that they are too fantastic and irrelevant. They are talking about a completely different time than us, different lives, different cultures, different problems that bear no resemblance to our own. I mean, giants? Really? There are no giants today. Well, that's not what Terry Sweetser thought. He knew there were giants, and he went to go visit them. Spy on them might be a more apt description. Terry Sweetser, some of you might remember, was minister of the UU congregation in Charlottesville, Virginia, during the 70s and early 80s. Charlottesville, as I'm sure you know, is right next door to Lynchburg. And Lynchburg, I'm sure you know, is the home of Thomas Road Baptist Church, the pulpit of Jerry Falwell. Thomas Road Baptist Church is a giant. At the time that Sweetser went to go visit, they had 15,000 members, more than 25% of the population of Lynchburg. Sweetser went to visit Thomas Road Baptist Church to try to figure out how these giants had come to occupy the land that ran with milk and honey. Donning the incognito attire of a typical Lynchburgian, he arrived on a Sunday morning and found an array of very nice, very welcoming people who were eager to help him park and find a seat and answer questions and provide him with information and show him around, which was all extremely disappointing. Why was it disappointing? You have to understand that Sweetser had come prepared to be indignant. He had secretly hoped that he would discover exactly what he was expecting to see. That is, the reason that all these people had become giants and occupied the land of milk and honey was because that they were fakes and marauders, that they were phonies, wolves in sheep's clothing, who had fooled the good people of Lynchburg into believing that Falwell and his followers were good people instead of spiteful, narrow-minded people cloaked in the pretense of righteousness. But despite all his best spying, he, at least initially, couldn't see any evidence. He was greeted warmly, welcomed graciously, and the people he met were all thoughtful and kind. Fortunately, Sweetser remembers, Falwell preached a completely outrageous sermon, completely devoid of any reason or compassion for the disenfranchised and lacking basic reason and common sense. "Great," he said. "This is what I had hoped for, to discover that the reason that they have become giants is because they are ignorant and selfish and lazy and unreasoning sheep. Obviously, we don't want to be that. If that's why they are growing, we don't want any part of it. We don't want to become like these giants." Sweetser, before he went, had arranged to have a conversation with Falwell after the service, hoping to say exactly that. But it turned out that Falwell needed to catch a plane somewhere, and an assistant minister was found who he could speak with. And so they sat down in an office, and Sweetser immediately began to lay in on how ridiculous the sermon was. And he brought in biblical criticism and historical context and pointed out how the sermon suggested that society moved toward division and prejudice. And the assistant minister listened patiently until finally his patience ran out. And he said, "Why don't you just stop? Just stop. You're not here to talk about the sermon or discuss theology. You're here because you're scared. You're here because you're scared that we took this church of 23 members and we grew it to 15,000. You're scared because we raise more money in one service than your entire denomination raises in a month. You're scared because we do more social justice in one day than your church does in a year. You're scared because we have figured out how to enter the promised land and make our dreams come true, and you haven't." And all of a sudden, Sweetser had nothing more to say. Every once in a while, should really clean this out someday. Every once in a while, we are stopped dead in our tracks. All of our dreams, our vision of who we are, of who we would like to be, buckle under the strain of some inarguable truth, like the sound of crunching metal when it hits an immovable object. When I was 11, I bought my first 10-speed bike, a Schwinn racer. I had saved a long time to get that bike, and on the day that I bought it, we were going to our church's canvas dinner, and I was inside the garage polishing my new bike with pride. And so transfixed was I in my admiration of my new possession, I had ignored the first two calls of my mother, who was in the car ready to take off. And so when the horn honked again, I came racing out, opened the big door of our Plymouth station wagon, hopped in and slid over to the middle seat, thinking that my sister was going to come in behind me. She didn't. But my mom, already in a hurry, started to back down the narrow driveway. Now, along the side of the house was a chain-link fence that ran the length of the driveway and got narrower and narrower. And as my mom backed down the driveway, the door caught the fence and began to fold backwards with that horrible mangling sound that steel makes when it is pushed by something immovable. And with a shockwave of panic, a hard foot hit the brakes, and the car came to a startling halt, but not before the door had been folded and torn backwards by the fence. And with her hands gripped tight around the steering wheel, my mother's face jerked around to the back seat where I was sitting, her face filled with pain and desperation, less than a foot from mine, and she screamed, "Gregory Scott, I just can't afford you." And then she just stared at me for a full 3 seconds with her face turning white until her eyes rolled back in her head in sudden realization of
what she had just said and what it really meant. And she turned back, facing frontward, and put her head on the steering wheel. And she began to cry. So this is what it comes to, thought Moses. This is how our dream ends, a screeching halt just before the promised land. It had been a journey that he thought was leading home, a journey where he and his people found themselves standing before insurmountable obstacles, but obstacles which in the past they had always found miraculous ways to overcome. And he felt that it was possible this time too, if only they could find a way to convince the children of Israel that it was their time to become like giants. But it was their fear that wouldn't let them listen. Their fear of the long-necked ones that scared them and made them look into the eyes of the promised land and scream, "I just can't afford you." As many of you have guessed, this is not just another story from the Bible. It is about us as much as it's about Moses. And it's about UUs in the South. It's about the Bull Run Unitarian Universalists. It is the story of a congregation with a penchant for dreams and a desire to make them come true. It's a story of a community whose destiny had been decided by conviction and courage, about a people who manifested the miraculous over and over, people who lived in neighborhoods where religion was constantly being bent backwards to the whims of the narrow-minded, a land where the truth is accustomed to coming only from one book and is interpreted only in one way to believe and one way to behave. It is the story of a certain group of people in an uncertain time who, against great odds, built a place for religion to be that was based on conviction and purpose and reason and love. It is a story about a community who is committed to being a presence in Prince William County, for they know that this could truly be the promised land, but only if they are willing to assume their place next to the giants, the long-necked ones who already occupy this land. The dreams and endeavors of this congregation have always raised eyebrows and expectations among your sister congregations, particularly miraculous to many as the example of ambition and tenacity that led to your being named a breakthrough congregation in 2008. That distinction came from a commitment to seek justice not only for ourselves but for our neighbors and our children. That came from an old historic building filled with good people and good dreams, people who are willing to go into the land of the long-necked ones because that is where their promise was. People who are willing to live among giants, who would not be deterred by hardship or fear or doubt or even a few tears. I don't know how long my mom cried there on the steering wheel. It seemed like a long time because my mom almost never cried. I remember, on the one hand, wanting to just get out of the car and hop on my bike and ride away. But on the other hand, I knew the promised land that I wanted to get to was nowhere I could find on my bike. The promised land felt much more like a place where I was affordable, where I was afforded a future, which meant that the people could afford to love me for who I was with all my gifts and misgivings. When my mom finally turned around, the first thing that she said was she was sorry. I asked her if it would help if I sold my bike to help pay for the car. It was then that the tears really began to run down her face, and she said she was sorry again. She told me that we could talk about it later, and we drove to church. We drove to church. That place where I had come to know that no matter what was going on, no matter how hard or painful life was, that I was affordable. That place where I could always count on getting at least a glimpse of the promised land. I remember not knowing how much it would cost to fix a car door, and then wondering if my bike or even I was worth that much. And I remember wondering about how much exactly was I worth. I don't know if anybody of you noticed Friday in the New York Times, but there was an article that actually answered that question. The government, in all of its wisdom, using the Department of Agriculture and Department of Transportation and Department of Health estimates, calculated the cost of raising a child from birth to 18 years old in a middle-income family. Anybody know how much? How much? $435,030. That doesn't even touch college tuition. For those with kids, that figure leads to wild fantasies about all the money that we could save if it had not been for insert name of your child here. But $435,030 is not bad if you break it down. It translates to $24,168 a year, or $2,014 a month, or $465 a week, a mere $66.40 a day, less than $3 an hour. Still a sizable sum if you're trying to be rich. However, if you're trying to be rich, it can also be a great investment. What do you get for your $435,000 in naming rights? First, middle, and last. And a few more things. You also get glimpses of God every day. You get more love than your heart can hold. You get a hand to hold on to, usually covered in jam. You get to frame those pictures of houses drawn with rainbows over them and curlicue smoke coming out of the chimney, and spray-painted noodle wreaths done at Christmas. You get to learn how to put the training wheels on and then take training wheels off your child's bike. You get to remove splinters. You get to fill wading pools. You get to worry a lot. You get a front row seat to history, witnessing the first step, the first word, the first bra, the first date, the first time behind the wheel. You get an education in psychology and nursing and criminal justice and communications and human sexuality that no college can match. You get the power to heal hurts, scare away monsters under the bed, patch broken hearts, police slumber parties, ground them forever, and you get a chance to dream without limits of what they will be someday, so that one day they will, like you, learn how to love without counting the cost. That is who makes it into the promised land, Moses thought. Those people who learn to love without counting the cost. That is the way that communities are built. That is the way that justice emerges. And that is the way that children feel valued and affordable, and how they learn themselves to be courageous and generous when the generation that raises them makes it a point to love without counting the cost. You can look up and down the streets of this city, and I guarantee you that all the big churches that surround Brew became giants by recognizing this very principle. You can think about the biggest churches in our area and their fancy buildings and fancy PowerPoint worship and their television broadcasts. They didn't become big because they started using PowerPoint. PowerPoint is irrelevant to who they are and how they got there. They got big because they had big dreams, and they backed up those big dreams with big commitments. A lot of those mega churches have big mouths, and they end up making a big noise and sometimes a big difference in the way things turn out in the world. But it all starts with having a big dream and being willing to put big money behind it. We have big dreams. Who are we to be given such big dreams of freedom and reason and tolerance and diversity and justice and love if we are not willing to do what they ask us to do, if we are only willing to live in the shadow of giants? When I went into ministry, giving up a well-paying career as an engineer, I didn't expect a lot of people to understand why I did that, but one person who I knew would understand was my mother, because I knew that 25 years earlier, she and I had had a very valuable lesson, a lesson about what real love and real risk and real promise was all about. I have learned about generosity in part from her, but I've also learned about it from many of you and other congregations that I have been with. Women and men who live in places like this who have taught me to rise up to the level of my dreams and to love without counting the cost. It is this generosity that is calling us to the promised land. And we can get there from here. We can if we are willing to move into the land that flows with milk and honey and find our place among the annex. We can become giants for our children and our future. We can reside among the long-necked ones. All it requires is that we be willing to stick out our necks to the glory of life.